Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Palisades Podcast. I'm Steve Krohn with my partner, Miriam Czar. Good evening. Good afternoon, Miriam. How are you?
How do you know what time it is when people listen?
I don't know. We're in the dark in the historic Village Studios, so it's hard to know what time it is.
We've been in the dark for a while since March.
We have. So we are honored today to have someone who doesn't live in the Palisades, but he's what I consider an honorary citizen of the Palisades. Chief Armando Hogan has been a fixture in the Palisades for the last couple of years. I first met Chief Hogan when he spoke at the community council, and he was talking about all the things that they were going to do to keep us safe. And then I said, well, would you come speak to the Highlands? And we had an assembly at Calvary Church for about 180 people. And you came out with some other chiefs and gave us a whole lot of information. So we have all been indebted to you. I know you're on the job taking care of us and other communities around the west side of Los Angeles. So welcome, Chief Hogan.
Steve, thank you very much. And Miriam, it's always a pleasure to see both of you. Thank you for having me here in this beautiful facility.
It is. It's great. And, you know, you have been, for the last few years, the person that has been the eyes and the ears of the LA Fire Department in the Palisades. And, you know, we've had to evacuate a few times. And you were at my house about a year ago when we were talking about doing a evacuation drill in the Highlands, and we would have done it last June, but for COVID. So you're somebody that belongs on the Palisades Podcast, and we're happy to have you here.
Thank you very much.
Miriam, you want to get started or leave it up to me?
Yeah, definitely. So as Steve says, Chief Hogan, it's been a pleasure to have you around since we met you. You'll have to tell me when you first came to the Palisades, but I remember a few years ago, I want to say a good like 3 years ago, we had what was a safety meeting for the community. It was a general safety meeting. And as you know, there's always these issues in every community, but particularly in the Palisades, we had homelessness that we grappled with. We have fire that we realizing we need to grapple with. And then we have general crime. And I can't say that we're the biggest crime community in the world, but we have several schools. We have a lot of different communities who live in the Palisades, right? We've got elderly, we've got younger people, we have people with kids, we've got a couple of parks. There's now Potrero opening. So we had this safety meeting, and that was really, I feel like that was the Palisades' introduction to you. And you were such a clear voice in that room, for which I have to thank you. And I think at the time, I might have been honorary fire chief for the Palisades. So I have to thank you for that. It was great to have you. And I know we're going to talk about your life, but just to begin, when you look at the Palisades, and I know this conversation has been had, like we've talked about, how do we evacuate various communities? A lot of them are hillsides. Those streets meander and then, you know, kind of dump into one street. When you look at the Palisades, does it worry you at night? Like, do you think, how am I going to evacuate 22 tiny little streets out into one other tiny little street and then out into, you know, PCH, which is the only way to get out? Or do you guys have a plan?
Well, to be quite honest, we have a plan. But to answer your question directly, yes, I'm always concerned. And I'll tell you why. It's a mixture of two things. Number one, it's the safety of the community we serve, which is the beautiful Palisades area. And then also my firefighters. Because, you know, anytime we have a situation or a circumstance, particularly like a brush fire that's fast moving, going in a direction that is going to impact structures, I'm always concerned about that. That's probably the biggest thing that will keep me up at night. However, I do sleep comfortably knowing that my resources are available and our firefighters are going to take excellent care of you all. And you've seen that throughout. I always like it when I don't get phone calls after we've had a small fire that could have gotten a lot larger, but no one knew about it because of the quick work of our firefighters. So absolutely, it makes me worry, but I'm honored to provide service to such an outstanding community.
When the most recent fire that I recall that actually touched the Palisades was up on Palisades Drive, that was one where you guys were all over it, and I remember kind of being stuck up in the Highlands, watching the smoke and the fire going up and running inside, watching it on TV, and you guys were all over that, and there was very little damage that was done. But we all sat there and said, boy, if the wind started blowing up the canyon rather than blowing just up the side of the cliff, who knows what would have happened? And I guess a lot of this stuff is you do the best you can, but you can't always know for sure what the conditions are going to be like.
Well, fortunately, one of the things that we do on a regular basis is weather is my best friend. Every day, For example, when I leave here, I'll go to either a weather call or I'll get information regarding the weather. And that's how we plan what our deployment is going to look like in those areas, because we have to get ahead of the game. I need every advantage I can because wind is king. And I'm not so much worried about a fire in the hillside as I am a fire in the hillside with a strong wind, right? So kind of two different things there. So what we, particularly in the Palisades, since we're speaking about that particular incident, my biggest concern there more than anything else is a lot of folks think because as soon as you see flames that they're anticipating us evacuating you. We're not. Our goal is 98% of the time, we want you to shelter in place. Because by adding more vehicles, by bringing more people onto the highway, it creates more congestion. And if I've got to bring additional resources in, more fire trucks, more fire engines, more ambulances, whatever the case may be, then that's going to be congested and it's going to create a problem. Just like we had there, I actually had some folks who came from the summit, believe it or not, up at the very top, and drove around and said someone told them to come see me because we were evacuating. And I said, well, I appreciate you being able to know me by name, but that's not what we're doing. And it created a backup. That's why we understand the importance of communication. And that's why I always want to have those evacuation exercises, because I don't like to call them drills, because drills imply that we do it on a regular basis, right? But right now they're exercises, and we just want to exercise where your preparedness level is. The biggest thing for me is I want you to know what the LAFD is doing. So when you see me standing there with the little Suburban and we got the lights going and we got the breadboard out and you see us working on that, what we call a 666, which is basically a situation status and resource status big board for us, I want you all to be comfortable. If you see me there, you know what that means. If we're going to say shelter in place, you all know what that means and you know what to do in your home in preparedness for that. If we say we're going to evacuate, hopefully you all have your go bags at the ready. So it's at a moment's notice that you can leave and you already know how many folks you have in the family, what the ages are, your pets, medication, all of those things. So I want to make sure that you guys are absolutely at the ready, because if we partner, will be more successful. If the right hand doesn't know what the left hand's doing, it's really, really going to be dire.
And that is, I think, the consistent message I've gotten from you in all the times that I've heard you speak. Be prepared, work with us together. We're much better if we're all on the same page rather than you trying to go your way and I go mine. You know, in the last fire, the one up in the Highlands, there were a number of people that were told by LA Police Department officers to drive up the hill and try and get out the, quote, fire road up
right
at the top.
By the Marquez Knowles connector.
Which created chaos because there was no way to get up. They were driving up and being told to turn around, drive back. And so my impression is every time there's a fire, you must learn a lot of things about what to do.
Absolutely.
How to handle it, what
yes
to do for the next time.
And the biggest takeaway that we learned from there was two things. Number one, the information that was not accurate in terms of what we wanted the community to do. And then secondly, when we were allowing people to come back in, because remember, we blocked off Sunset while we were addressing that issue because of the concern of falling rocks and my firefighters in the street and hose in the street. So also, I really felt bad about the fact that we could have communicated better how we were going to do reentry, right, and rehousing and letting people come back home. So from that, we learned right off the bat, two things that we'll never do is we try not to rehouse you at night, particularly, if you've had extensive damage in a particular area. We want to make sure the infrastructure is in place, so your utilities, all of that, and we'll have firefighters there to be with you. The beauty of it is we work so closely and in concert with LAPD that that's going to be our security arm, because a lot of folks say, if I leave, who's going to watch my belongings? LAPD is great about getting their motorcycle units to come out, their mobile field forces, and they can move around our hoses and they can do everything, and it gives them a lot more versatility. So we train on a regular basis, even during COVID, just probably about a month and a half ago, just had a lot of the folks from the West LA with Captain Tom and all my dear friends there, you know, Cap Goddard and all those individuals.
Captain Tom's right down the street about a block from
very
where
true
we are today.
Right there, exactly. Yeah. We can go knock on his door when we leave. And the beauty of it is that we know each other. I know what they're going to provide. And most importantly, we're in sync. So that helps in terms of the service delivery to all of you. And that's our goal. We want to make sure that you know what we're doing. None of this should be a secret. However, I do have people that ask me, you know, Chief, how come you don't give us the maps? And I tell them all the time, if I give you the maps, you're going to take independent action. And that's going to take or divert my firefighters from addressing whatever the threat is to having to go save folks. Because everybody thinks on a clear day and they go, there's the fire road right there, or even like the connector that we have between the Highlands there and Marquez Knowles. But you've never been up there at night. You've never been up there when it's smoky. You've never been up there when it's chaotic. And that's difficult to plan for and train for. So that's why I always say, we're going to put resources there. If I ask you to shelter in place, we'll have fire engines up there with firefighters that'll be able to give you direction in terms of what's going on, to give you that situational awareness so that you're not starving for information. And that's why I always stress, as I segue into something else, is our alerts, right? Either through Notify LA with the city or our LAFD alerts. That way you'll get blow by blow what's taking place so your situational awareness is accurate. And you can say, that's what Chief Hogan and I talked about. So that way it kind of gets you through. And hopefully it's an anxiety reducer, because that's the main goal. If I can keep you calm and keep you safe, then I feel like I'm doing my job.
Yeah, I was actually just going to ask you what your biggest communication tool is, because that does seem to be the most important thing. So as a case in point, that fire that we're talking about in the Palisades was over the ridge from me. Mm-hmm. So I could see it, but I didn't necessarily think I lived in the same neighborhood. And information, I mean, I was getting my information through the alerts,
right?
Maybe because I'm familiar enough with the city to know that that's a reliable place. But there were people that were, I live at the end of a cul-de-sac and we had a pretty good view of the flames. There were people who would be driving up the cul-de-sac just to see what was going on. And then they'd talk to neighbors and, you know, try to figure out what they should be doing or what the situation was. And it occurred to me that, you know, communication is probably a huge challenge for you guys, and you probably need tools to do it. One of the things that helped me, and again, we were on a street that was somewhat impacted, so we had a lot going on. Mm-hmm. But I did notice that there were, I mean, the two fire trucks that were parked on our street weren't even LA fire trucks. Mm-hmm. I think one was county and one was from a different, maybe Santa Monica or just a different city. So I did notice that you have a lot going on. You have a lot of coordinating. You probably have communication coming out of your ears. Mm-hmm. But to just let the impacted people know, that's got to be a challenge.
It's always going to be a challenge. And I'll never say it's as seamless as I would like it to be, because when I don't get a complaint, then I know it was effective. Mm. But if I get a complaint, and don't get me wrong, sometimes the complaints are valid. Notice I said sometimes, not all the time. But when folks say, I didn't know, the first thing I want to, or I was not told, and I'll ask, have you opted in to our fire LAFD alerting? Have you opted in to Notify LA so that we can give you that information? The other thing that I do when I get on scene, because I think gone are the days where I'll be pulling hose, running up a hill and billy goating like some of my firefighters. However, I'll leave it to
you
those young
folks.
You still
could, but you just choose not to.
I still could, but I choose not to. Thank you. That'll be a long recovery.
Yeah.
But what I always try to do when I get on scene is three things. The first thing that I want to do is make notifications. So I'll reach out to our what we call our public information officers and say, here's where we have the incident. Here are our concerns. I want you to put a geofence around this area initially so that we can send alerting out to those individuals who have opted in, and then we can give them some situational awareness, right? Part of that notification also is media, because I can also speak to everyone through the media. Then the next thing, which is very important to me, is the health and well-being of my firefighters. So even though they're out there working, depending on time of day, I got to see, have they eaten yet? So I got to look at a meal plan to make sure that, because I want them ready to go. I don't want somebody, you know, having headaches because they haven't eaten, because they're not going to be at their maximum output. So then the last thing that I'll always do is, once again, is coming back to that media piece. Because I want to notify folks, I want to feed my folks, and then I want to make sure that the media, that we message that to those who are at work, to those who might be wanting to come home, and we say, wait, hold on a second, you know, go stay 20 more minutes at wherever you were, because we've got to try to get a plan in terms of getting folks back in safely. So that's just what I'm doing. The other members of my staff are going to show up. One will be the liaison officer. So when we have those other resources that come to those incidents, we can coordinate where we want them and have accountability for who they are, where they're from, and most importantly, how we're going to keep them safe and how we communicate with them. Another one of my members is going to go and help on that breadboard to make sure that all our situation status and resource status is accurate. What resources do we have on scene and where are they or where are they working? And what we call that is a CAR or a PAR, company accountability report, or a personnel accountability report. So that way we have that. My number two, my assistant bureau commander, is going to shadow the IC or transition whoever is running the incident and make them the operations chief. So they're handling all of the tactical aspects of the incident. They're standing back at that 15,000 foot level looking at where do we want this to be in 15 minutes? What do we want it to look like in 20 minutes? Where are we putting a box on a brush fire that we can say this is where we're going to make our stop? Where are we going to stop the forward progress? So we have all of these things, and that's just with my folks that I'm bringing my staff. In addition to that, I'm calling for the world. I've got 106 fire stations, I've got 127 work locations, and I won't hesitate to pull
that
trigger.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. You oversee a pretty wide swath of land, right? Chief Hogan, you go from the airport, which is its own little city,
yes,
all the way over to Hollywood, Los Feliz, Griffith Park, Silver Lake, the hillsides of the canyon communities that border Hollywood, Pacific Palisades, Bel Air, West Los Angeles, and that includes UCLA, which again is its own city. Mm-hmm. That is a very wide swath of land for you to look over. How many people assist you? I mean, kind of at the oversight 15,000 foot management level.
The folks that assist me, I have my immediate staff, and then I have my battalion chief. So I have 9 battalion chiefs. I have 3 per battalion. So my battalions are battalion 4. And just to give you a kind of a landmark of where battalion 4 is, that services LAX. Mm-hmm. Battalion 5 is predominantly Hollywood, and then Battalion 9, which is you all, the Palisades in the West Side. So I've got those battalion chiefs.
So we go all the way from Hollywood to the Palisades?
No, you guys all go from basically from UCLA west for all of you all. You know, Bel Air there and then coming down. So I have those additional resources that are there. Those are my initial eyes and ears. They'll get on scene, do what we call a size up. They'll name the incident, give us an idea of the resources and where they need to be placed, and then we'll come in and provide support for them. We don't come and take over an incident. We always show up to provide assistance and support because we have to work together. I can't preach to you all about us being partners and working together, and we don't model that behavior. So those are the additional folks I have, in addition to those 106 fire stations and 127 work locations that I can get folks there too. So I'll call for the world because the worst thing that happens for me is I'd rather have them and not need them than need them and not have them, right? And I can always send them back home. I call for the world, and if I don't need the world, if I only need half the world, then I'll send that other half back to continue to provide service to the city of Los Angeles, right? Just because Chief Hogan has an incident in West Bureau, Central Bureau still needs to provide service, South Bureau and Valley Bureau. So it's a coordinated effort, but we try to work it out.
My compliments to your Battalion 9. They are honestly the nicest people I've ever met.
Thank you.
Not just in the Palisades, where I think we all get to know our fire people because they're great and they're in the community and they're so open and, you know, they're just great. But, you know, I was stuck in Brentwood once with my kid. And, you know, your fire station in Brentwood was like, oh, come on in. They had my child, like, looping rope just to keep him busy until we were done doing
teaching him how to tie knots. Yes.
Yeah.
He's
I mean,
a future firefighter anyway. We know that, Miriam. We'll talk about that
later. Now know that.
Yes.
Yeah. So you guys are part of the community, and it's great.
Which is a perfect, perfect segue, because Miriam knows that I always like to, when we have guests here, I like to find out how they got to this place in their lives. And I have 3 kids, 5 grandchildren, 2 are boys, 1 son and 1 grandson. And from their earliest moments, they were always carrying around little fire trucks. So, I mean, they didn't grow up to be firefighters, but was that something that you were into at an early age, or did you come into becoming a fireman later on?
I was very fortunate where I grew up in Compton, where my dad still lives. My mom passed away some 17 years ago, rest her soul. But I grew up, my next door neighbor, we were facing west to the south of me, was a firefighter for the city of Compton. Across the street from me on a diagonal area was a firefighter for LA County Fire. And then directly across the street from me was a captain from the city of Compton Fire Department. So I was surrounded by these individuals. And because growing up in my neighborhood, I was always trying to prove myself because I was younger. The people I hung out with were a little bit older. For some reason, I'll attribute that to the good Lord and just a whole lot of luck. But those firefighters took an interest in me. So they were my football coaches, my basketball coaches, my baseball coaches. And I'll never forget one day, there was a gentleman, Larry Winston. He has since passed away as well. Larry was a very handsome individual and just always in great shape, always exercising, jogging, lifting weights, things of that nature. And I'll never forget one day we were getting ready to go do something stupid. I think we were going to go have a rock fight or something like that that we were doing. So Larry grabs me by the shoulder and says, "You're coming with me." So my mother loved Larry. Larry could do no wrong. So I could go anywhere with Larry. I couldn't go any place with anyone else. And I was always trying to sneak off and go hang out with these folks. So Larry takes me down to fire station, which is right across the street from City Hall now. And he took me there. He allowed me to slide the pole. He allowed me, at the time they were doing a survey of some sort on waterbeds. So I got to lay in a waterbed there at the station. And I'm looking around, Miriam, and I'm saying to myself, I like this. And then what even made it better, Larry had a really nice car back then, like the Datsun 240Zs and cars like that. Yeah. Larry had one of those because he was single. And Larry, the women loved Larry. And so Larry always had a nice car. Nothing real flashy or anything, just very nice. And then he had the prettiest girls. And then across the street, the gentleman there, his name was Reynolds Cross and Gary Cross. Both brothers worked one worked for Compton, one worked for L.A. County. The lady who lived next to store to me, Larry's sister, Jeannie, was every bit as beautiful as Barbara Eden to me. And Gary dated Jeannie. So once again, there's that connection of a good-looking firefighter in great shape, a good guy in the community, someone to look up to, dating these beautiful girls. So it really had nothing to do with me wanting to run in burning buildings. It had more to do with driving nice cars and meeting beautiful women. So that was pretty much my entrance into the
And once it started, you knew that was the direction you were going?
After that was it, because what happened at that point in time, once I expressed an interest, and you'll see that even with firefighters today, they become forever mentors at that point because they know they like to replace themselves, irrespective of what organization or what department they work for. So a lot of times they would say, "Hey, I'm going to be coaching here," because they recognize a need in the community for them to be the role models that they needed to be in, the mentors. So I started being on his baseball team. I was on his football team. So after that, I was always hanging out with him. They would take us to the beach on Saturdays, right? And of course, the beautiful women went as well. So we were always up and eager to go for those trips. So they were always taking us places, exposing us to things. Now, mind you, I had a mom and dad at home, and my dad worked with LAPD. The only challenge was, you know, there were times where LAPD didn't agree with some of the things I was doing. So I had to stay more on the fire department side of it. But my brother became a police officer, and he was, matter of fact, he just retired with about 32 years as a detective. So my dad worked with LAPD for 41 years as a civilian. So I was always exposed to probably the best of the best in terms of what behavior, in terms of being a role model in the community, and most importantly, the expectations that come with that, meaning what's expected from you from the community.
Because I worked in, I think I told you earlier, I worked in Compton for a couple of years when I was a public defender, and back in the 70s, and it was a crime-ridden area, at least a lot of parts of Compton. And it sounds like you had this protective shield, like there were people around you that weren't going to let you get into any trouble.
That's exactly what it came down to. Now, don't get me wrong. Compton, to me, probably wasn't any different than a lot of other communities. But for me, the beauty of it was there were a lot of pockets where the folks in the community really looked out for you, particularly if they saw potential in you. And I mean, even some of the folks that you would probably think was, wow, that's person who I probably wouldn't want to hang out with, were always very protective of us. For example, I remember one time we were playing football at a different park, which was probably about 2 or 3 miles from where we lived. Well, the guys in the neighborhood, the older guys, and a lot of them were like lowriders and stuff, they came to that park to make sure we were okay, that there weren't going to be any problems. Nothing happened, right? Because usually when everybody got together, they kind of looked at each other and had the old face down, and that was it. So I was very fortunate for some reason, and that's why I attribute this to the good Lord above and a whole lot of luck, that people took an interest in me. saw potential that obviously I didn't see, but for the most part, really kind of gave me the opportunity to access success versus going down a path of trouble.
And my guess is you do the same in the community you live right now.
Absolutely. You know, I don't coach anymore now. My daughter gets on me all the time now. She says, you know, you got to get back out and start coaching. I used to coach football probably, almost 20 years. I used to coach T-ball, started with my son because it was a great opportunity for us to bond, started with T-ball and then later baseball. But I enjoyed coaching and also just giving these young folks an opportunity because we don't aspire to the victim mentality at all. You know, the bottom line is we want to do what we can. Now, mind you, we are aware of the challenges that folks face, whether there is a single parent home or they, you know, economically disadvantaged, whatever the case may be. But I always like the fact that we had the opportunity and the means to pay to allow them to continue to compete. And it's much like what Debbie Allen does in the community. My daughter danced with her, and she and Norm are really good friends of ours and have just been wonderful. But they always give those folks an opportunity to express themselves, to participate, and costs shouldn't get in the way of that. So I really felt good that I was already modeling that even before I met them. But to see that continuing to be carried on, it really makes you feel a lot better in terms of what you're doing. And I don't do it for any recognition. I do it because I'm supposed to. And someone did it for me. And when I used to go to them and say, what can I do? Like when I got on the fire department, I couldn't wait to get back home and run over to the fire stations and show them I was in my uniform and all. And they looked at me and they said, okay, so now what you gonna do? I was like, well, you know, I'm looking for a little congratulations or something here. And they were like, we knew you were going to do that. What are you going to do with that platform that you now have? So I became an active recruiter. I became an individual that would at least seek out their advice so I can determine what should we be doing to make it better for someone else.
I love that. Somehow we knew that he was going to say, now I reach back. And you certainly do.
Well, it's not surprising given the fact that you've come into our community, and I assume all the others, or are you saying we're the only one that you feel this way about?
Well, as I'm on the Pally podcast, you're my favorite.
I knew that.
Very wise. Chief Hogan, it's clear that you have taken your instinct for PR to a different level as we speak. You also went and got an education that relates to what you're doing today. Did that happen afterwards? Let me just let everyone know, because it is nothing short of impressive. So you hold a bachelor's degree in emergency services. You then went to University of Southern California, where you got a master's degree in leadership. And then, as if that wasn't enough, you still went to the Harvard Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, obviously, where you got an executive certificate in preparedness leadership. So all of these obviously have something to do with the work that you do, and I'm sure they were inspired along the way. But how did you fall into education, and did you sort of do it after you knew that it would apply to your life, or was kind of leadership and, you know, was leadership and management something that compelled you from the beginning?
In all honesty, when I was so gung-ho about getting on the fire department. Once I got on the fire department, I was very young. I was right at about 20 when I got hired, started at 21 years young. So this was only my second job in my entire life. The other one was working. My dad was with LAPD, but he also had a family service station on the corner of Century and Figueroa. So that's kind of where I learned from the elders. Like I had one of my uncles work for Water and Power. I had another uncle that was a heavy-duty equipment mechanic for the city of L.A. So I had all of these different individuals that I can go to and pull from and learn from. So I got to a point, particularly when my uncles passed on, and I would be at the kitchen table at a fire station, and everybody would be talking. And there'd be the newspaper there, and we'd read the news. And I was always a student of not only leadership but education. I always thought that was important. And my mother always stressed that. And the thing that really opened my eyes, I'll never forget, I asked a question to this individual in the fire station who was kind of what we call the bull engineer, person who's got a lot of standing in the station and you don't cross him, you don't say anything to him. And me being the naive individual that I was, he was making some statements and I said, where'd you get that information from? Actually wanting to know where he got the information from, although it was taken as though I was challenging him on the information. So because I started to see a lot of misinformation in the fire station, not from a negative standpoint, but people just didn't know. Sometimes you don't know what you don't know. So I said, you know, I need to do two things. By then I had children. By then I was married. And this was like after about 10 or 12 years on the fire department. So I said, I've got to model the behavior for my children. I can't tell them that you're going to go to college and you're going to do this. And one of the first questions they're going to ask me is, Dad, what's your degree in? I don't have one, right? So that's what started me on that path. When I got my bachelor's degree, I didn't feel like it was enough. And I wanted to challenge myself from a leadership perspective because I wanted to be able to speak from a platform of research, of inclusion, and then most importantly, of accurate information. That was the thing that bugged me the most, when people would just say anything and people would believe it, kind of like what we see in some circles now. So then I wanted to go. I was never a USC fan. I was kind of more of a UCLA.
All right.
Individual.
I'm glad to hear that.
I was going to. But I quickly became a USC fan.
Oh, no. Because don't tell me this.
One of a dear friend of mine who worked in the 9th Battalion, which is Palisades, name is Pat Butler. There was a program at USC. You know Chief Butler. And Chief Butler knew I was pursuing education. And he said, hey, are you going to go for your master's degree? And I said, you know, I don't know. I got to look at costs and all that. And he said, oh, you shouldn't let that get in the way of you. He said, you really need to reach for that and get it. Well, anyway, he knew someone at USC because Chief Butler knows everybody. And I ended up going there. They allowed me to come and sit in and kind of shadow during the class. And I met the professor there and fell in love with the program. And it was actually a leadership program. And it was at the Saul Price School of Public Policy
at USC.
So, yeah. And it was very based on leadership. And I wanted to be a leader. I wanted to be an emergent leader. But most importantly, like I said, I wanted to be a leader who was speaking from a known perspective.
Right. Knowledge was important.
Exactly.
To you.
And I wanted to have credibility when I spoke. So that led me there. And then the next thing was I had heard my wife attended school at college at Holy Cross. So she talked about Holy Cross and Harvard and, you know, some of that. So I had to explore that option as well because I just wanted to be on the campus to be with what they considered some of the preeminent thinkers in the world. And I wanted to be a part of that. So that kind of led me on my educational journey.
How did you meet your wife? Oh, first, Chief Butler. So Chief Butler was around when we, I want to say 2014, mm-hmm. when we put up the very first signs in the Palisades that designated some areas as high fire severity zones.
That's
and
right.
That was an effort that we undertook with the Pacific Palisades Task Force on Homelessness, which was new at the time, and
right.
I was the chair. And Chief Butler was hugely helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And I know he moved on from there. He stayed in touch with the Palisades for a while, so please give him our best.
I will do that. I will do that. I just spoke with him the other day, so he's doing well.
Good, good. I'm glad.
Mm-hmm.
How'd you meet your lovely wife?
Well, in all honesty, there was a nightclub downtown called Little J's, and Little J's really catered to police and firefighters because you could show your ID and you could basically get in for free. And they served food there and everything, and I met her. And this one particular night, I was there, and it was a two-story facility. So we, like, the firefighters were usually upstairs, and the police officers were kind of downstairs.
Because you guys could use the pole and come down if you had to get out.
Well, it was the banister that we had to use. There wasn't quite a pole. But however, she was sitting with a group of her friends, and a couple of the guys that I was standing around said, hey, you know, we asked her to dance, and she didn't want to dance with anybody or anything like that. And I was like, okay, well, let me see. So I walked over and extended my hand. I said, would you like to dance with me? And she said, she looked at me up and down, and she was like, okay. So we danced. And then after that, I walked her back over to her seat, and I said, you know, thank you very much. That was it. I just wanted to see if she would dance with me. She didn't dance with them, right? Because I wanted to be able to tease them. And mind you, I was only about 23, 24 at the time, so I was still pretty young and immature.
You were quite a gentleman.
But that was one thing I was raised. My father was, he would settle for nothing less. So anyway, after that, she was leaving. And as she was walking out the door, I stopped her and I said, are you on your way home? And she said, yeah. I said, well, be safe. And I know later on when we talked, she thought I was going to ask for a phone number and all that. And no. Well, eventually I'd see her more and more. We continued to dance. And the next thing you know, 27 years later, we've been married 27 years, probably knew her about 30,
wow.
32. She's from New York. She's a native New Yorker from Brooklyn. Her family's still there at Coney Island section. So she had come out for a wedding, fell in love with California because of the weather. And of course, I tell her all the time, she really came out here to find me.
I know. I was going to say, you got lucky, but hey, maybe she got lucky.
No, I think I got lucky because she's a wonderful lady.
And you have two adult kids?
I do.
What do they do?
My son works with the courts to assist wayward young folks in terms of getting them on a path and trying to make sure that they have help and services that they need, particularly those who are either bipolar or have drug addiction problems, things of that nature. My daughter works with AIDS Healthcare Foundation. She was an events manager where she planned all the events in different cities and states throughout the United States, and now she just moved over to communications. And she has a podcast that she does because she actually manages some talent. And
as opposed to us?
Well, I told her last night, I said, I'm doing a podcast.
You are the talent, you know, today.
Oh, no. My daughter is really talented. She is so much like her mother. It's just ridiculous. So I'm a little jealous because it's interesting. Like if I say something and my wife's not home, she immediately steps into the wife role. You know what I mean? Like, Daddy, you know you can't do that. And I'm okay. And she's my baby, and she can get away with anything she so chooses. So,
yeah.
And she's 25, and I still think of her as my baby. So,
And she's got you wrapped around her finger, like
fingers,
nobody's business.
Toes, whatever. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Daughters are precious.
Yes. And like I said, the beauty of her, though, is she's really an independent thinker. I like the fact that, you know, I was always worried because sometimes, you know, your children can be a better version of an experiment, right? Where you say, okay, I'm going to allow them to speak their mind. I'm going to allow them to do this or that. And you don't know, you know, how that's going to end up. But it's ended up really well. I'm very, very proud of my children. And they're both degreed. So I'm very happy about that as well.
And you said your mom is still alive, right?
No, my dad is still alive. My mom passed away.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Mm-hmm. And your dad is still in Compton?
My dad's still in Compton, yes.
How has Compton changed through the years? I mean, when you go back, or I'm sure your father talks about it, how is it metamorphosized through the years?
Well, it's interesting. My dad and mom met at Compton High School, and they both went to Compton College. And it was a lot more diverse back then. And I still remember that.
It used to be a white community.
Yes.
50, 60 years ago.
Exactly. And this was in the mid-50s, mm-hmm. when they were, or early 50s,
yeah,
early to
years.
Mid-50s. Right. So, and then the other thing with Compton, for me, Compton was always and remains. I just love the city of Compton. And I tell you why. Because I learned so much from so many folks. I learned to be a little more streetwise. I learned the importance of education. I learned the importance of friendship. I learned the importance of what not to do. I learned the importance of what you should do. So it was just such a vast education. Some of the changes that I've really seen now is it's so much more progressive that individuals refuse to take a hand out. They prefer a hand up, which I like. I see that we have more ladies that are in stronger political roles. I would like their city council and mayor to be a full-time position. It's a part-time position. But for me, even the other day, because my mom is where she's buried, when I go visit her, I have to drive through pretty much downtown Compton. And I just have so many memories. You know, Steve, you were talking about when the city hall was just one story, and now it's like seven stories or whatever it is. And even the design of it looks different.
Yeah.
And the stores that we have in Compton now, and just, you know.
When I worked there in the 70s, I remember looking out from the 8th floor, public defender's office, looking east, and there was nothing. Mm-hmm. It was just a vast nothingness. There were some homes around that, but it was like empty. And now there's stores and shopping centers. You never could go out to lunch when you worked in that building unless you got in a car.
Right.
There was no place you could walk to.
That's right.
It wasn't safe, and there was nowhere to eat.
Mm-hmm.
So, Chief Hogan, what prompted the growth?
I think what prompted the growth is a lot of folks like myself who grew up there. Number one, came back and reinvested in the community. And I also think, too, it's just you don't like being characterized all the time as a problem. You know what I mean? I think that has a lot to do with it. Now, also, too, we always look at the end state of issues. We don't look at what the task, purpose in the end state. We just look at, well, the end result is there's a problem. We don't look at, well, what led to that? No one wants to be in poverty. No one does. No one wants to be strung out on drugs, meaning that's my firm belief. But, you know, you have those problems. You want to look at what assistance is provided. What does that look like? What support do you get? And like I said, Looking at it now, when I drive around, I see now, you know, we have a lot more of a Hispanic population in Compton as well. And like I said, I'm really proud of the fact that, you know, I'll never shy away from saying where I was born and raised, because that's what made me who I am today. And the friendships that I was able to make, and, you know, even the young girls that were my age who I had a crush on that demanded to be respected, that you weren't going to just be pulling pigtails and, you know, putting your hands on them and things of that nature. It was such a great education where like in my neighborhood, we had block parties a lot. And at every block party, before we got to have a block party, we had to go down to Mrs. Smith's house because she had Bible study. And we all had to go to Bible study before she would get the permitting for us to be able to block off the street and have a block party. So there were so many what I consider core values that were instilled in us, in addition to allowing us to have fun. But
when I was there, I had the feeling that the core element of Compton were really good, hardworking family people. At the time, there was a lot of gang violence, the Crips and the Bloods, and there was a lot of bloodshed on the streets, but the people that lived in those homes, oftentimes scared behind bars because of the random shootings, were such fine people that I remember feeling so bad for them that they were involved in this gang war. And ultimately, I think that's moved on to other areas. I remember one of my proudest possessions was I had a yellow T-shirt that I got from City Hall, and it said, "I Heart Compton." Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I wore that thing till the threads wore out and people would see me in the west side of town. They'd say, "Oh, ha, ha, ha." I said, "No, I really do love Compton." Mm-hmm. And I used to wear it everywhere, and it finally just fell apart. But there's something charming about the town.
I feel like some of the change that happens in communities is most effective when it comes organically from the community. And I wonder if, I mean, I read a lot of it. I read about it like it happens in Boyle Heights. It happens in different parts of the city. But I wonder if one of the things that started to take shape was that people who were vested in the community and were part of the community, and like you were saying, could identify why things were the way they were. They were part of the reason that it was that way, started to be empowered and started to be able to make the changes or even have a say in the policies or the programs, you know, the nonprofits that would come in and implement programs. I wonder if it was because people began to have a voice in changing their own community, because Compton today is a place people want to be, right? Talent comes out of Compton. Mm-hmm. Compton is a perfectly safe place to live. Mm-hmm. Like you say, generations that have moved on have come back and reinvested. Mm-hmm. So now it's a great place, but I feel like that had a lot to do with Comptonites.
Well, and I would agree with that. I think the other thing that people lose sight of, particularly after a lot of things that happened from the type of policing, and that's been well chronicled, like what they had with, what LAPD did, you know, back when. And we had a lot of programs. Like when I grew up, there were Cedar programs. The parks were open where you can go swim. There were a lot of things to do that kind of got you focusing on your future. When they started taking away those programs for whatever reason, there was nothing for a community to do. And what everybody says a lot is, they should have done X, they should have done Y. Well, if I compared my community to yours and looked at the resources that you had available versus what I no longer have, then that creates the problem. So when you talked about gangs, all gangs were at that point in time, because I knew a lot of those folks who were in gangs, is it was just a club. Now, it became a little bit more violent when, you know, based on what was happening in the community, there were no opportunities. There was no place to go get a job. You know, like you all have the Pacific Palisades Homeless Task Force. I think that's so wonderful when you bring in a success story about someone who was homeless and you all basically nurtured them back into becoming a productive member of society. But because they have a vehicle or they have an outlet or they have the area or the road to traverse to get back to that, I just think people lose sight of that because they're so quick to condemn, but nobody's really willing to look at, well, what can you do to help? And if that were you in that circumstance,
what would you want?
Exactly. Right. So that's, you know, and I get it. You know, people talk about the crime and they talk about this, but I remember looking at the news when I was growing up, and the only time I would see something about Compton is if it wasn't good. Back then, we used to have parades. There were a lot of stuff that we were doing that usually did not get televised. And I think that was a systematic approach to how they probably felt about certain people of color.
I mean, every community has its bright spots. And yeah, it's important to be able to hear about all of them. So we are nearing our end of hour. I want to say that it really has been a pleasure to talk to you. I've known you for a few years, but this conversation has really enlightened me about who you are and what makes you tick. And no wonder you're as wonderful as you are. So this has really been a pleasure for me. I hope everybody listens up to this.
Oh, Miriam, first of all, I appreciate being able to be in your company, you and Steve. You guys are great. I am so grateful and so thankful of your involvement in the community. Because, you know, we always say in the fire department, if I can just get some involved community members, we could take this to new levels. Now, you have to be careful what you wish for, because sometimes there's an over-involvement.
Maybe not that level
exactly,
you want to go to.
Exactly, but I will take that over a lack of involvement any day. And anytime I've reached out to you, because you are one of our former honorary fire chiefs and you serve that role impeccably, I just like the fact that you all care. You know, Steve, having us at your home to talk about our planning for, you know, evacuation exercises and the importance of what
and
we need to do.
And you know I'm going to be calling you to set up the next one.
Not a problem. And you know I'm going to come back running
because
we can't wait to do that. I miss this face-to-face because, you know, we would have had about 4 or 5 town hall meetings by the end of this year. And we're going to get back
planned
to that. But
they
we're not going to let that discourage us. We're going to use Zoom. We're going to use all of those platforms. We're going to do what we need to do to get our message out. And most importantly, keep you all safe.
Well,
so I can't thank you all enough. So thank you.
Chief, we appreciate you so much. Here you are coming into our community and taking care of us and watching out for us. And I hope that we can watch out for you, too.
Well, you guys do. Thank you very much. So on behalf of our fire chief, Ralph Terrazas, and the many members of the Los Angeles Fire Department, I am honored to be able to provide service in your community because your community is my community. And that's why I feel the way I do, because nothing's going to happen on the west side without me doing some serious intervention. So.
And we are honored to have you here as
humbled
our guest.
Humbled to have you here. Thank you,
look
Chief Hogan.
Look forward to many more years of working together.
Thank you very much.